Well, welcome, as I say, to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. Glad to have you listening here. In this part of the program, we will be talking about what is probably the most famous shootout in the history of the Old West. And what we're talking about here is the gunfight at the OK Corral. This took place in October of 1881 in the town of Tombstone, Arizona, and involved Wyatt Earp, two of his brothers, and Wyatt's friend, Doc Holliday, and on one side, and on the other side, the Clanton and the McClary brothers. It's the basic story. Probably people will have a sense of the basic story, perhaps because it has been retold so many times. It's been done in movies. It's been done in print. It's one of the big, most famous stories of the Old West. Probably, though, what a lot of people will not know is that afterwards, the principals in this, the Earps and Doc Holliday, were put on trial for murder. That is the subject of a book that we'll be talking some about this morning. It's titled Murder in Tombstone, The Forgotten Trial of Wyatt Earp. And the author is our guest, Stephen Lubet. He's professor of law at Northwestern University, where he is director of the program on advocacy and professionalism. And he's authored a number of books on legal strategy and trial advocacy. And as you might expect, being that that is his area, he's interested in this trial and the various strategies and the performance of the lawyers in this trial, both the prosecutor and the lawyer who was the principal defense lawyer for the Earps. And that is what this book is about. It's published by the Yale University Press. Very interesting reading, and you can seek it out in the bookstore if you would like to take a look at it. And of course, this morning as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at some point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call us. Professor Lubet, hello.
Hello, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I know we were having some trouble with the line.
Well, and I'm sorry we didn't. We were going to have a little bit of a more high quality connection, but I think I can hear you just fine.
Great.
And that'll work out. We many shows we do this way, just with a regular old telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So glad that you could do it. Just to start out, I guess, because I sort of have this feeling that maybe almost everyone who is listening to us has at some time in their lifetime seen a Western that has a gunfight. And I'm talking about the kind that, you know, you have your good guy and your bad guy who stand on opposite ends of the main street of the town. The townspeople clear out. Maybe they're watching, you know, from inside buildings and peeking out through the curtains. And here the two guys face off with tumbleweeds kind of blowing in between them. And that it's a quick draw contest. And, of course, the good guy always wins. And that's generally the end of the movie. Well, one of the things that you point out in the book is that actually if you look at the history of the Old West, that just didn't happen.
Right. It probably never happened.
Yeah.
The face-to-face slap leather quickest gun in the West, that probably never happened, although we've seen it in films from High Noon to The Quick and the Dead.
Mm.
The closest that ever came to happening, though, it was, in fact, in Tombstone, Arizona on October 26th, 1881, when the, as you said in the introduction, when the Earps and Doc Holliday on one side approached the Clanton brothers and the McLowry brothers on the other side, and there was a the guns were put away and the guns were drawn and there was a shootout. And at the end of it, three men were dead.
Right. The other thing that I think is that's a basic point that the book makes is, again, it goes to this idea of what our perception is of the Old West and that there were these fights and that basically when it was over, that was over. You know, the undertaker came and took away the bad guy, who, and of course, always the bad guy, and they would to be taken off to Boot Hill, and that was that. And in fact, the point you make in the book is that there was a system of justice in the West. There were courts, and indeed, people were that when something like that happened, if indeed something close to that happened, or someone was shot, or there was a fight, that wasn't just the end of it. There were indeed trials.
Yeah, that was almost never the end of it. There was one of the first things that happened whenever a territory or a town was organized was that there would be a federal marshal or a town sheriff or county sheriff appointed, and the people who lived there were very concerned about violence, just as concerned about it as we would be today. And they didn't like the idea of people being shot down, which did happen with some regularity. I mean, there were gunfights or there were shootouts. They just weren't the duels, the stylized duels that we've seen. And they very frequently ended with trials. In addition to the Earp case, for example, and another famous Western hero, Wild Bill Hickok, was arrested and charged with murder at one point for shooting a man.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we're going on to maybe talking a little bit about the event, or at least what we know about the event, and it is the history of this thing is contested to this day, what I found really interesting is that there, if you look at the background, the atmosphere, it turns out that it's really complicated when you look at the personal, the professional, and the political rivalries that existed between the various individuals in this case, not only between the Earps and these other men, the men who were in the gunfight, but also between the Earps and the political structure, the other people who were in law enforcement in the town at the time. There was this really very complicated atmosphere going on that existed even before this happened.
It was almost Byzantine in its complexity, and when you consider the fact that it was a town of about 6,000 people, in a territory with, I don't know, maybe 30,000 people at the time, it's astonishing how the rivalries could have been as intricate as they were, probably promoted mostly by the fact that everybody there was trying to get rich. Arizona was as far away from civilization as you could imagine in the 1880s, or as far away from central authority as you could imagine. But there was a tremendously rich silver strike, which attracted people from all over the country to this boomtown of Tombstone. And on one side, you had sometimes they're characterized as the forces of capital development, Eastern business men who owned the mines, who owned the businesses. They were primarily Republicans, and of course, as businessmen everywhere, they were interested in stability, law and order, and development. And the Earps were part of that, part of those forces. Mm. On the other side, you had rural Democrats, Texans, former Confederate soldiers or officers who resisted federal authority and were interested more in ranching than in mining. And these two forces were really sort of aligned against each other. Politically, economically, and in terms of law enforcement. And then, as you mentioned, each side had their own peace officers. The Earps, Virgil Earp, who was actually the head of the family, was the deputy federal marshal and the Tombstone chief of police. In between those two levels of authority, there was Cochise County, where the sheriff, Johnny Behan, was a Democrat. And he was the arch rival politically and in some other ways. I'm sure we'll get to that. He was the arch rival of the Earps. He was actually in the hearing the principal witness against them.
Mm-hmm. And there, just to make it that much more interesting, again, in addition to the sort of political rivalries, there were various personal rivalries, and one of them concerned Wyatt and Johnny Behan and a woman. It was a love triangle.
Right, the beautiful and mysterious Josephine Marcus, who had come to Tombstone as an actress with a company called HMS Pinafore on Wheels. It was a stagecoach that the company went from town to town performing Gilbert and Sullivan. She had fallen in love and was living with Johnny Behan, who wouldn't make an honest woman of her. Apparently he had promised marriage, and marriage never happened. And at some point, we don't know when, her affections turned to Wyatt Earp. We don't know how romantically linked they became in Tombstone. They eventually married and spent 50 years together. But somewhere in there, she fell in love with Wyatt, and of course that created the triangle, Johnny, Josephine, Wyatt, which was probably, we can't be absolutely certain, but which was probably in full swing actually at the moment when Sean Bean was testifying against Wyatt Earp.
Yeah. That's one of the interesting things, I think, to me about Wyatt Earp is just how he was, how as an individual, just if you looking in terms of his the period of his life, how he straddles two different ages, because the gunfight that we're talking about takes place in 1881, and then Wyatt Earp himself lived until 1930.
1929.
Pardon me, 1929. And, you know, that's a and when you see the two pictures, there are a couple of photographs of him in the book. There's one from 1887 where he's wearing clothes of the period and he's a younger man and he has this big handlebar mustache and looks like someone that you would expect to see in a Western. And then there's a picture of him in 1929 and looking like, you know, sort of a man of 1929, still has a kind of a brushy mustache, but he's dressed in clothes of the period, and
almost looks like a contemporary businessman.
Yeah, indeed, he looks like he might be your grandpa, and it's the fact that's again another one of those things that I think probably people wouldn't really realize that he lived so long into the next century.
And Josephine lived until 1940, so she really brings us almost up to the contemporary era. One of the things, though, fascinating about Wyatt Earp is in some ways he's really responsible, not just for straddling those eras, but for bringing the world of the 1880s into the 20th century, because it was a book about him, Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, written by Stuart Lake, that really popularized or repopularized the whole story of the Western hero. And Wyatt himself was a technical advisor on the early Hollywood sets when they first started filming Westerns. And finally, the story of the O.K. Corral, the gun duel at high noon, it actually happened at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but the afternoon gunfight in the street, which, as you pointed out, is the model for so many Western movies, well, that is very much derived from Wyatt Earp's story.
Yeah. Another thing that's kind of interesting about the story is that it involves this three sets of brothers, the Earp brothers, the Clanton brothers, the McClary brothers. It was a matter of family in some respects too.
Yeah, there were more brothers than that. There were the Masterson brothers too, Bat and Ed.
Uh-huh.
I think blood was thick in those days, and in fact. As you know, there was a third McLowry brother who showed up in Tombstone after the gunfight, and he played an important role in the prosecution.
Well, let's talk for a second about Ike Clanton, who we talked a little bit earlier about some of the rivalries here, and there particularly there was a rivalry involving between Wyatt Earp and Johnny Bean, who was the Cochise County Sheriff, and it had to do with the woman, and that perhaps was part of the reason that Johnny Bean was such an important witness for the prosecution and seemed to kind of have it in for the Earps. But now the reason that the fight took place as it did was this fellow Ike Clanton, one of the Clanton brothers, was going on that day, was basically going around town saying, you know, those Earps better watch it. There's going to be a fight and we're going to take care of them. And, you know, it was sort of going around town, shooting off his mouth, causing trouble. And that eventually he kind of precipitated the fight, although also interestingly enough, at the time the fight took place, he was not armed and left.
Yeah, he ran away.
So he ran away. He, you know, so he, in a sense, he was kind of at the center of it all. And yet when the shooting started, he was out of there. And I suppose in a way you can't blame him because he wasn't armed. What was his grudge against the Earps generally or Wyatt Earp specifically?
Ike Clanton was a cattle rustler. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And he belonged, maybe belong is too strong a word, he hung around with a sort of loose confederation of cattle rustlers in the Arizona area they called them the cowboys. In those days, cowboy didn't mean a hard-riding ranch hand. It was actually a derogatory term for semi-outlaw, part-time cattle rustler. And McLowry's hung around with the cowboys too, although it's not so clear that they were rustlers. But about Ike Clanton, there was no doubt. And on the day before the gunfight, October 25th, 1881, he got into a fight, an argument with Doc Holliday at the Alhambra Saloon. And and Wyatt and Virgil broke up the fight, but Ike wasn't having any of that. And he spent about the next 18 hours storming around Tombstone, carrying guns in violation of the local ordinance and threatening the lives of the Earps. At one point, Virgil Earp pistol whipped him and knocked him senseless and took his guns, but Ike kept stomping around, threatening the Earps. And it probably wouldn't have come to much, except that the next afternoon, Ike's brother Billy and Frank McLowry rode into town, heavily armed, as men generally were in that area, and this became very suspicious and very threatening to the Earps, because it looked as though the cowboys were arming themselves and, you know, and getting ready for a fight. There had been a series of incidents between the Earps, who were lawmen, and the cowboys, who were rustlers, dating back about a year and a half. So the possibility of a confrontation was always present, and suddenly it looked as though there was going to be one. Tom McLowry and Frank McLowry and Billy and Ike Clanton huddled together in fact, the OK Corral, and it looked as though they were all carrying arms, although it turned out that Ike wasn't, and it's not clear whether Tom McLowry had his guns. But it looked as though they were all armed, and as long as they stayed in the OK Corral, Virgil Earp, who was the chief law enforcement officer, decided he'd leave them alone, because perhaps they were riding out of town and it was legal to have guns if you were headed out of town. Then, for reasons that no one's ever going to know, the cowboys left the corral. They actually walked down an alley into a vacant lot next to a photography studio that fronted on the street. The gunfight didn't happen at the OK Corral, but nobody wouldn't be very interesting to talk about the gunfight in the vacant lot down the alley and around the corner from the OK Corral, so we don't remember it that way. But once they headed for the street, Virgil Earp decided that he had to act. He called on his brothers, who were deputies, Morgan and Wyatt, and he recruited Doc Holliday, handed him a shotgun, and said, "We're going to go down there and disarm the cowboys." And that was the beginning of the fight.
And just to take it one step further, and another wrinkle here, again, involving this man who was the county sheriff, Cochise County Sheriff Johnny Behan. He was a man who was seen, or maybe could be seen, as a kind of a cowboy ally, and perhaps was interested in avoiding violence. And so he went and talked to the Clantons and the McLaurys to see if he could kind of, well, who knows what his motivation was. And then he came back and said to the Earps, said, "Look, it's okay. I consider them under arrest. It's a questionable whether they consider themselves under arrest." But then we come to a very contentious point where the Earps later claimed that Johnny Behan had said, "I have disarmed them." Now, he apparently said, "No, I didn't say that," but they did. And they went with the intention, I guess, of arresting them, and suddenly found themselves face to face with men who were armed when they didn't expect them to have guns.
Right. That's one example of the conflicting testimony at the hearing, which actually occurred the following week. The Earps claimed that Behan tricked them or threw them, and Behan said, "No, I didn't say anything of the sort." Actually, here I think the weight of credibility is with Behan. If the Earps believed that the cowboys were disarmed, there was nothing left for them to do, and yet they kept marching down the street. I mean, there was no arrest to be made if Behan had gathered their guns. So it's always hard to resolve conflicting testimony, and harder still after 120 years, 125 years almost. But here I think you have to think that Behan was probably telling the truth and the Earps weren't, or at least there was a good faith misunderstanding. But in any event, the Earps came into sight of the Clantons and McLowrys, and Billy and Frank were clearly armed. They had six guns in plain sight. Virgil Earp called out, this is also undisputed, "Put up your hands, boys, I've come to disarm you." And then there is a second, maybe a second and a half in dispute. And the question is whether Billy and Frank reached for their guns, that's what Wyatt and Virgil said, or whether Billy and Frank did indeed put up their hands, which is what Johnny Behan said. No good answer to that question, but immediately afterward, the shooting started, and Frank and Billy and Tom were all killed, and Morgan and Virgil and Doc were all hit. As you said before, Ike Clanton ran away, and the only man left standing was Wyatt Earp.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Labette. He's professor of law at Northwestern University, where he is director of the program on advocacy and professionalism and has written a number of books dealing with legal strategy and trial advocacy. And he's also the author of a book that looks at not only the events here we've described, but what happened afterwards, the trial. And the book is Murder and Tombstone, The Forgotten Trial of Wyatt Earp. It's published by the Yale University Press. We're going to take just a pause here for a moment in our story so that we can bring you an important message from our sponsors. Oh, wait a minute. The listeners, they're the sponsors. So now is the time for them to step up to the plate and say, oh, you mean it's time for me to give money? Oh, yes, it is.
Afraid so. Actually, I'm not afraid so, because it's a heck of a lot better than airing commercials throughout the show. Just imagine what Focus 580 would be like if we had to break every 5 minutes for a commercial announcement, you know. That wouldn't be much fun for us, and I don't think it would be for you. You're used to the show being a very thoughtful place for exploring things in depth. So we want you to go to the phone right now. There will be no gunfire involved, no shooting. But if you will please dial 217-244-9455, make a pledge. This is your last chance during this fund drive to support David Inge and Focus 580 and the other producers and all the other things that you hear on this station with your pledge. Basic membership level, $40 a year, 11 cents a day. And if you can afford more, certainly, the member card level, $75. That gets you 2-for-1 discounts at area restaurants and all kinds of places around. And so, again, the pledge line, 217-244.
That's the other number.
Thank you.
I know.
217-244-9455. Rita Schulte is our membership director. We have a couple phones going, Rita?
Yes, we do. We have two folks on the line right now, and we're waiting to fill up our other three phones. I want to update you guys. We're at $102,460 toward our pledge goal of $140,000.
That's really good.
That is exceptional. That we've got a way to go, but you have any idea how far we've come since a week ago, this coming Saturday? It's astounding. Mm-hmm. And we want to say a global thank you to the thousand-plus folks who have called in their pledges. It's a pretty remarkable thing when you think about it. You set up five phones, you open the key, you say please, and 1,000 people respond because they find this something they value. If you are also someone who finds this something of value, we want to encourage you to call us at 217-244-9455. As our station manager, Jay Pierce, is wont to say, we can talk all we want about the value of our mission and the quality of our programs, but if we can't afford to do it, what does it mean? And that's where you come in. Friends of WILL support us to the tune of about half of our annual operating budget. There's a significant amount of money that comes from those of you who pledge during fund drives or mail in your renewal. We want to thank you and encourage you, if it's time to renew, take a moment now. You can save yourself that stamp. You don't have to write a check necessarily. Give us a call. And if you use a credit card, we'll send you the Whimper Map, Jack.
The Where Is My Public mm-hmm. Radio Map. All the public stations throughout the United States, if you're driving, comes in a little bit handy.
Yes, and there's a phone number. You know, you get a hold of that thing, and you're driving across Route 80, and you see, wow, 88.6. And you're dialing around. You go, it's not there. But there's a phone number on the map now, so you can call and say, I'm here. Where are you? So that you can get a sense of exactly how much further you have to go before you can hear a friendly voice that you're used to hearing on public radio. So this is a nice little travel aid.
Right. Also, let's mention the website address, because we do take pledges yes. online as well. That's WILL.UIUC.edu. And I'd like to see a lot of people who are listening online contribute online, because that just shows that you value the thing that we're doing on the Internet as well as what we're doing on the air. And it's a way to support the Internet service and the overall service in general. Mm-hmm. So, again, WILL.UIUC.edu. There's a pledge link on every single page on the website. Or you can call the pledge line, 217-244-9455.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Jack, Rita, we'll check with you again at the end of the show. This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And again, our guest this morning is Stephen Labette. He's professor of law at Northwestern University and is the author of the book Murder in Tombstone, The Forgotten Trial of Wyatt Earp. Well, we do have some callers, and someone here particularly has been real patient with us over in Indiana. So why don't we get with them right here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just the preface before the question is, I wonder how many other things we honor that weren't actually at the same place. I was thinking of the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now we got the OK Corral wasn't really where it was. So that's sort of answer my question is, your commentary has been extremely dense. And just I'll pick one place out where you said that they'd had problems with the Cowboys for the last year or 18 months. And then you went into talking about the trial itself. I'm sort of wondering, where are you getting your information, since so much of this stuff about the West is, you know, just not true? Where do you find, you know, things? Is it in letters or historical society out there, or where? Can you make comments like that for 18 months they've been having trouble with the Cowboys, and, you know, individual Cowboys, not just groups against each other? And that, you know, just sort of interesting historically, you know, where are the facts coming from?
There are a number of major sources. One is the transcript of the hearing itself, where a lot of these people testified. And we see both the competing versions and also the sort of uncontested facts that the principals testified about. There were also two newspapers in Tombstone that, by the way, the newspapers competed with each other, too. One was Republican and one was a Democratic paper, the Nugget and the Epitaph, and they carried stories about all the people who were involved. Tombstone was economically an important place because of the silver mines, and so in addition to the two local newspapers, the goings on in Tombstone were also covered in newspapers in Los Angeles, Denver, San Francisco, San Diego. And finally, sort of astonishingly, there were two diarists who just happened, you know, people who kept very, very detailed diaries of what was going on. There was a man named George Parsons who wouldn't really be noteworthy for any other reason, but he kept an extremely detailed journal which has survived. And there was a woman named Clara Brown who was also sort of a part-time journalist and she kept a journal. There are also letters that have survived and memoirs. A number of the people who were there wrote either published or unpublished memoirs.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a general background question. In the movie Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood sort of sets up this theory that the violence was in the Old West was caused by large... to a great extent, I'll say, by drunkenness, and the alcohol abuse was the result of the sheer misery or physical hardship of their lives. When you were doing the research, did you think, you know, it sounds plausible, but like a lot of things that sound true, maybe it's not. What did you find?
A lot of the violence in the West was caused by alcohol, particularly in places like Kansas, where the Earps had lived and worked in law enforcement before they ever went to Arizona. There what would happen was that the cattle drives from Texas would come up to the railheads in Kansas, and in fact, the drovers, they called them, or the cattlemen, would hit town after months on the range, and they'd go to saloons and get drunk and start shooting. But interestingly, most of that was kept under control without the lawmen firing back. Wyatt Earp's favorite move in Kansas was to come up behind some drunken Texan and smack him on the head with the butt of his revolver. That was called buffaloing, which was usually sufficient to bring him under control. In the years that Wyatt worked in Kansas, it said that he only actually fired his weapon once, and he mostly used it as a club. Going back to Tombstone then, there isn't much doubt that Ike was drunk and out of control, and his blustering was caused by alcohol or aided by alcohol. But the Earps themselves were pretty pretty self-controlled. Doc Holliday was thought to be a drunk, but Wyatt actually was a teetotaler.
And what about the second part of the theory that a lot of the alcohol abuse was directly due just to the physical hardship of life in the Old West? Did you get any information on that or anything that would indicate?
There's nothing that tells us that the McLowrys were any drunker than anybody else or Billy Clanton. And as I said, the Earps were known for their sort of puritanical ways. If they drank, they didn't drink much. I think today we see in rural areas there's a lot of alcohol abuse. No reason to think that didn't happen in the Old West as well.
Mm-hmm. But the physical discomforts and difficulties of life, I mean, did any of that come up in the research? I don't think that we are really, so far apart from that time and so many differences. It's hard to imagine exactly what their lives were like day to day and just the difficulty and
Well, you know, I'll tell you, one of the interesting things is that a lot of the principals in this case ended up committing suicide, oddly. I mean, many more than you would expect. And so clearly there were serious problems with depression and desperation.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Just to follow up on one point you mentioned a little bit earlier, the fact that in the town of Tombstone, it was against the law to, as sort of a routine matter, to carry a gun, to openly carry a gun. And I guess it was okay if you were, the deal was that you were on your way out of town, that would be okay. But if you were just walking around town, it was against the law to carry a gun. How common was a law like that in the West?
Well, in the towns, it was very common because everybody was armed, and there was always the problem of accidental shooting or drunken brawls, and so it was very important to the people who ran the towns to keep that potential under control. And in fact, what would happen is that men would ride into town with six shooters, and they would indeed check them with the bartender at the hotels or the saloons, and then pick them up when they were headed out of town. You had to have an exception for arrival and departure, obviously, or else you'd had to have toll booths or something, yeah, you know, at the edge of town, which they clearly didn't have.
Well, I wanted before we end up running out of time, to talk a little bit about the trial, because, as I said at the beginning, because this is your interest, that's something that you really concentrate on, and the performance of the prosecutor and the defense attorney in the trial. Do I have it right that essentially what we come down to, going back to the way you summarized the events before, was that on the side of the Earps, they said that we came up against these men, we were led to believe they were unarmed, we suddenly discovered that they were armed, and that one of them said, "Put up your hands, we're here to disarm you," and that what the Earps said was...
No, the Earps said that,
The Earps said, "Put up your hands, we're here to disarm you." And that then the Earps said, somebody went for their gun, we felt that our lives were threatened, so we had to defend ourselves.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you heard it seems that the principal witness for the prosecution was Cochise County Sheriff Johnny Behan, who said that he felt that the McLowrys and the Clantons were in the process of surrendering, and that the first shots were fired on the other side. And in fact, he fingered Doc Holliday. He said, "Well, he was the one who fired the first shot," and perhaps he did that just because Doc was not a particularly popular figure, and it was a way of attacking the Earps, but doing it indirectly. So essentially, is that the two strongest witnesses on the both sides were, on the one hand, the Earps saying self-defense, and on the other hand, Johnny Behan saying, "No, the Earps fired first."
Johnny Behan and Ike Clanton testified for the prosecution.
The other guy who was the survivor of who was there at the beginning and then left.
Johnny tried to blame the beginning of the shooting on Doc Holliday, which now here the weight of credibility favors the Earps. Almost impossible that Doc Holliday was the person to shoot first because he was carrying a shotgun, and yet Behan claimed that he fired first with a nickel-plated revolver. And that inconsistency really can't be explained away. Mm. So here you have an example of Behan, I think, clearly lying. Why was he lying? Well, very easy to blame the shooting on Doc Holliday. He was a gambler and a gunslinger and a disreputable fellow. He was also a dentist. There wasn't much bias against dentists in those days, but Holliday had plenty of reputational problems. And it was very hard to blame the beginning of the shooting on Virgil Earp, who was the town marshal and a very upright, honest, straightforward man. So there you see a real credibility contest, and it has to favor the Earps. But the big problem for the prosecution, and the reason they lost. Oh, by the way, I should say this wasn't technically a trial. It was actually, in legal terms, it was a preliminary hearing.
And when it was the longest preliminary hearing in the history of the state of Arizona, something
probably
like that?
To this day, and certainly right. In those days, it was the longest by orders of magnitude. It lasted for 30 days, and there were 30 witnesses examined. As I explain in the book, really both sides treated it as though it were a full dress trial. It was a trial in all but name.
Mm-hmm.
But the big problem for the prosecution. The big problem for the prosecution was that they were insistent on bringing a case of first-degree murder. Well, first-degree murder requires proof of premeditation, so they had to come up with some explanation, not just that the cowboys were shot trying to surrender, but that it was intentional, that for some reason Virgil and Wyatt and Morgan had marched down the street intending to kill innocent men, and that was just a huge stretch to try to convince a judge that Virgil Earp would have done such a thing.
And you also make the argument that you think if the prosecution was arguing for a lesser charge, something like manslaughter, you think that it's likely that they could have been successful.
If the prosecution had argued for manslaughter, very likely they would have at least won at the preliminary hearing stage.
Mm-hmm.
There was plenty of evidence, sufficient evidence, to support a preliminary hearing finding of manslaughter, but much, much harder, almost impossible, to convince the judge that there was enough evidence to charge Virgil Earp with first-degree murder, which carried mandatory capital punishment.
And do you think that going back to the kind of, again, personal, political, professional rivalries we talked a little bit earlier, that the desire on some people's part to see the Earps not only convicted but get the maximum sentence led to the prosecution to take that strategy to make the maximum charge rather than something lesser?
Yeah, it was clearly a huge blunder, I mean, in legal terms. If you try to look at this clinically as a lawyer and say, well, what were the decisions that the attorneys were making, the biggest mistake on the prosecution's part was to really press forward in an all-or-nothing way for capital murder. And that's explainable because one of the prosecutors was a man named Will McLowry, who was the brother of the dead men, Frank and Tom. He was from Fort Worth, Texas. He actually showed up on the third day of the hearing. And you can see a tremendous change in the prosecution strategy once Will McLowry inserted himself in the case. Early in the hearing, all the options were open. The prosecution was presenting a case that could have been interpreted as voluntary manslaughter. But once McLowry gets on the scene, you see a real shift in strategy, and they just press and press and press on the premeditated murder charge.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Cell phone caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I don't know whether I missed the beginning of the show, so you may have mentioned this. One of the interesting things about this story is how unbelievably modern it sounds. I think if you file the names off and replace them with a bunch of names from today in some, in Chicago, Washington, D.C., particularly Los Angeles, from what I understand, it really wouldn't be all that strange. Do you care to comment on that?
No, I think you're completely right. The case that I actually sometimes compare this to was the killing of Amadou Diallo in New York City about 5 or 6 years ago. He's an unarmed man who was shot down in the street by New York City police officers who claimed they saw him, they thought he was reaching for a gun, and they thought they were firing in self-defense. It turned out, of course, he was an unarmed victim. The reason I compare the two cases is because those police officers were prosecuted and they were charged with murder. And of course, they, as everybody knows, they were acquitted. But I think the problem was that the jury just wasn't willing to convict police of murder. And if they had been charged with manslaughter, some lesser degree of homicide, I think there was a much greater chance of conviction in that case.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I remember once I read. I don't 100% remember why I was looking for this, but the internet has some amazing stuff on it, and one of them was a report by an FBI training agent. There was a famous gunfight in the mid-80s in Miami where the FBI lost pretty badly. I mean, they won in the sense that the gunmen all died eventually. They bled to death. But they lost in the sense that the agents, I think if I recall correctly, all of them or all but like one or two of them died. And this was kind of the inspiration for the movie Heat, where you have that giant gun battle through Los Angeles because the gunmen, the bank robbers, I think they were in this case, were wearing body armor. But anyway.
Sorry, I don't know anything about that.
Okay, well, what was interesting about it is this agent points out that, you know, even the best trained people can lose it in the middle of a fight and not, you know, things are going so quickly, you just don't even know what's going on. And when you look at it after the fact, you start, people after the fact start asking questions like, well, why did they, shoot three shots instead of two? And one of the things the agent was pointing out is in the middle of a fight, oftentimes no one knows. And so if you ask for a coherent story, like you were saying, at some level you can only piece it together so well just because one guy saw something and the other guy saw something and who knows what they saw.
The idea that witnesses will give you a single coherent story following an event like that is just a fantasy. It won't happen. It didn't happen in 1881, and it won't happen in 2005.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I want to see if we can get one more here. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. Professor, could you address to what extent, since the question of alcohol arose, the hangover of Civil War sympathies played in the state of Arizona, Democrats versus Republicans, and the Indian Wars? Because I think there is a role here. At least my dad, who was a Civil War historian and a Western historian, thought so. I'd be interested in your ideas on that. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
That's very important. I don't think the Indian Wars actually played a part, but as the caller put it, the hangover of the Civil War was very, very significant. Virgil Earp and his brother James were Union Army veterans and clearly Lincoln men. The cowboys, many of them, had come from Texas, where they were fleeing Reconstruction. They wanted to get away from federal authority. Another of the prosecutors was a man named Ben Goodrich, who himself was a Confederate veteran. And on a much smaller scale, that rivalry, Republicans and Democrats, Union forces, Confederate forces, urban versus rural, all contributed to the tension.
You know, as you mentioned, eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. Having said that, what was there in the way of eyewitness testimony where you had people who didn't seem to have clear sympathies, or at least weren't invested in one outcome or another, as the Earps were on the one side, and then on the other side you had men like Ike Clanton and Johnny Behan, who had, they were invested in one version of the story. The Earps were invested in a different version of the story. Was there much in the way of eyewitness testimony from people who you would say didn't really have much invested one way or another?
Most of the witnesses had obvious biases. Mm-hmm. The Earps clearly didn't want to hang, and Ike Clanton clearly wanted to hang them. Behan had his own biases. But there were two pretty neutral witnesses. There was a woman named Addie Borland, and a man named H.F. Sills, S-I-L-L-S, who was just passing through town. And they were not identified, or at least nobody knows whether they were identified with one side or the other, and they both testified favorably to the Earps.
Hmm.
Pre-
pretty much favorably to the Earps.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's much more that we could talk about. The story is told in greater depth, and the various sorts of nuances are all here in the book. And if people are interested, it really is fascinating. The title of the book is Murder in Tombstone, The Forgotten Trial of Wyatt Earp. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Stephen Labette. He's professor of law at Northwestern University. And I just want to say, Professor Labette, thanks very much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. It's been a great pleasure.